Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jack Beatty, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Renowned Italian author Umberto Eco stepped onto the world stage in 1980 when his first novel, The Name of the Rose, became a runaway success. Other novels followed, high-flying postmodern historical fictions. Now he's out with a collection of essays that first appeared in Italian newspapers. Casting his eye on Europe and America since 9/11, he writes of what he calls hot wars and media populism and suggests provocatively that history is running backwards. This hour, On Point, Umberto Eco on Turning Back the Clock. With me today from New York is Umberto Eco. In addition to The Name of the Rose, he's the best-selling author of Foucault's Pendulum and The Island of the Day Before. He is professor of semiotics at the University of Bologna in Italy. His new collection of essays is Turning Back the Clock, Hot Wars and Media Populism, which the London Guardian calls nimble, teasing, brilliant, and infuriating. Welcome, Umberto Eco.
Well, hi, Jack.
Well, let's get right down to it. You are sort of a latter-day Vico. Vico famously talked about the corso and ricorso of history, the running forward and the running back. And you see a ricorso at work now in the world, history running backwards. Can you put some flesh on that thought?
Well, I can mention certain starting point that struck me after the fall of the wall in Berlin, all the publishers had to throw away their atlases because the geography of Europe had radically changed. But they had not to publish new ones. They had only to recover the old ones before the First World War. And the situation of Europe was going back. And the second revelation was when I discovered that after Marconi, at the beginning of the 20th century, invented the wireless telegraphy, and now with Internet, we have invented the telephony with wires. So it's another way to go backwards. But those are, well, obviously paradoxes and jokes. But in the book, I try to show that, for instance, we went back to the hot wars of the 19th century. After that, with the Cold War, and then with terrorism and so on and so forth, the notion of war had radically changed. It couldn't be no more the confrontation of two armies, one in front of the other, two nations, because everything is very confused. And with Iraq and Afghanistan, we had a return to the 19th century wars. Then we had many returns. The return to the Crusades. The return to the anti-Semitism. In Italy, the return to a clash between church and state. I had the impression that history was tired to go on, and for a moment he made some steps backwards.
Now, you also talk extensively about the media regime, about media populism, about the ubiquity, the centrality, the inescapability of the visual media today. Is that related to the backward turn of the clock of history? Is there some connection between these phenomena?
No, I would say that this is, on the contrary, a brand new phenomenon. I started from the idea of populism. Populism, there are many notions of this term, but commonly is a way to make a direct appeal to people without the mediation of a parliament, of a senate, and so on and so forth. So it was typical of the great dictatorships. Think of Hitler, of Mussolini, speaking in a big square with 300,000 people hailing, And so establishing a sort of charismatic direct contact. Today, in Italy, with the case of Berlusconi, who was a political figure and at the same time the owner of three mm-hmm. of the big TV channels, and then once became the president of the council, he was controlling also the three state channels. He established a sort of media populism, a sort of direct appeal to people, so that some issues are discussed first in TV, then in the parliament. Better when the issue arrives at the parliament, it has already been settled in TV. It happens that in many talk show trials, who mm-hmm. is the guilty one, are discussed in the talk show, even by judges before coming to the tribunal, and the same for the political affairs. With that element which distinguished the media populism from the old ones, but mm-hmm. because at least Hitler and Mussolini had in face of them, if not the totality of people, at least a representative element. And 3,000, okay, 300,000. While the people to which the TV appeal is directed is only a fiction. It mm-hmm. doesn't mm-hmm. exist. It's invented at the same moment in which the charismatic leader speaks to them.
Mm-hmm.
To them.
Mm-hmm.
Because we don't know what is people. We know what people think at the moment of election. At that
yes.
point, we know that 50% of Americans
right.
are voting Bush. Okay, it is only a statistical element, but at least we can say what American people think. But otherwise, we cannot say, because people is a plurality of
people. And, we can never use all. All should yeah. be abolished.
But not only when you speak in television, you usually speak in the name of the people.
That's right.
Which is worse.
Yeah. Now let me ask you about that in connection with Berlusconi and with his dominance of the media in his time as president. You write, so in our own day, if there is to be a dictatorship, it has to be a media dictatorship and not a political one. Is that what Italy came close to under Berlusconi? And is that a sort of, you know, constant danger haunting the modern media world?
I think it is. I insist on the fact that as Italy has been a laboratory for instance, for fascism, they invented fascism, and then Germans, all the Balkans and Spain followed. Even in this case, it has been a laboratory in which it happened something that could happen tomorrow in every other society, developed society. That's why at the beginning, when I was always struck by the fact that when going abroad, they were asking me about the situation of Berlusconi in Italy and why they are so interested in our small provincial affairs. And then I realized they were afraid that this could happen also in France, in Great Britain.
And how would you define this? What sort of dictatorship or soft dictatorship was this?
Well, obviously, somebody has exaggerated speaking of a new fascism. It's untrue, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Berlusconi didn't put in jail his opponent. They didn't oblige young people to march with a black shirt and so on and so forth. But it's another form. It's a democratic form of dictatorship, mm-hmm. so to speak. But it can be equally dangerous. I want only to remind my audience that at the present, Berlusconi is no more at the government, but there are many possibilities that he will come back in a while. So the problem is always present.
Mm-hmm.
And so the problem that in also older society can could face exactly the concentration of the political power, of the mediatic power, in the same hands at the same moment, and mm-hmm. that can be very, very, mm-hmm. very dangerous.
Well,
the United States mm-hmm. cannot be governed by the director of the New York Times.
right.
By somebody who is the owner of the New York Times, of the ABC, of the NBC, of the CBS.
Yeah, that's right. Well, you
that's
know,
the equivalent.
Right. Right. Well, Tocqueville in Democracy in America worried about what he called soft despotism, that he thought that democratic societies were particularly liable to it, partly through the tyranny of the majority, the wish to be with majority opinion, and that this kind of despotism, he really feared for the future of democracy because of that, the worship of the majority.
I agree. I fundamentally agree.
My guest today is the Italian author Umberto Eco. Let me just return to this media issue and politics. Theodore White, who was the chronicler of our presidential campaigns, the author of the Making of the President series, said some years ago, quote, television is American politics. And he said it almost as if he were pronouncing a kind of doom. Studies have shown that television, its growth in a society correlates with falling rates of voting, with civic disengagement, and more importantly, and to politics, the criteria increasingly that people use about politicians are television ones derived from advertising, likability, Q rating, and the like. In the 2000 campaign, we heard again and again that George W. Bush was a regular guy, a more likable guy than Gore, someone you'd want to have a beer with. And these opinions were ventured by people in the media on no basis other than the way you would judge a product on television. And the result, of course, was Mr. Bush's election, and you could argue, too, the Iraq War. Do you fear that sort of thing, too, that politics gets translated into television and loses something in the translation?
But listen, the first paramount example were just the TV debate between Kennedy and Nixon. Mm. And it started, really, mm-hmm. at that point. It is not by chance that the White could speak of that at that moment, because if you remember, Kennedy practically won because he was more beautiful. Mm-hmm. And Nixon looked unshaved. Mm-hmm. Then you can tell, as I think, that Kennedy was better for many other reasons. He had better ideas, but from the point of view of the TV debate, he won because he had a good slogan, to the stars, to conquer the stars, and he looked right. Better. And at that point, it was the TV which decided. It was the first time, because try to think of that fact. Mm. In the whole history, except a few people, citizens had never seen mm. their ruler, yeah. be it a king. They saw sometime some portrait, mm-hmm. some description, mm-hmm. but except few people living in the capital city, they had never seen the king of the. It is only in our time that there is this possibility to judge of the quality of the power upon the visual appearance. Mm-hmm. Like, that's an mm-hmm. absolutely mm-hmm. new phenomenon, and We change as politics, obviously.
Yes, indeed. And what we expect from politics. We have some callers want to talk to you, Umberto Eco. Attila is calling from Waterbury, Connecticut. Welcome to the program.
My question for Umberto is, what does he find to be the root cause of this problem of media populism, the notion that he presents? And in that, does he offer a solution for this kind of, or an action plan for this kind of media populism? That is to say, are there a few individuals who are responsible for this problem with their biases, or is it an institutional problem? That's my question. I'll take your answer off the air. Thank you.
Thank you, Tia. Umberto Eco?
Yes, I don't know if I got completely the question, but I listened something about a possible solution. I don't think there is a solution, because the media populism is a product of our civilization. The solution would be, obviously, to elaborate on the part of everybody a critical attitude toward the media, but it's very difficult to reach. Maybe a possible solution can be given by the weakening of the power of television in face of internet. This will create... They say that the new generations don't read any longer the newspapers and don't watch practically television, but they watch a lot on the computer, on the computer screen. There are the risks of internet, as there are the risks of the media populism. For instance, the fundamental risk of internet that is that you can never know whether the source of your information is reliable or not.
Right,
and so you are exposed to a lot of.
Although one could argue that you can't really know that about the televisual media either. I mean, over here. Al Gore, in his recent book, The Assault on Reason, says that he doesn't think the Iraq War would have happened in a world where cases had to be made in print, on the paper. But television uniquely became a vector of fear in that circumstance.
Certainly. And in this sense, I think that internet can be a remedy because at least it presents a plurality of a point of view.
Right.
So it obliges the user to make a choice, to elaborate a certain elementary principle of criticism. Then there can be naive people who become victims of the first sight they meet.
Right.
Okay, but it's possible also when young people read bad books. Okay, it has always been possible in the past. There were magicians and people diffusing false ideas. But at least to be obliged to recognize plurality of point of view, plurality of language, even of languages. Because we believed a few years ago that internet would have diffused a sort of basic English everywhere. But in fact, internet is proposing to a lot of people at least the existence of other languages.
Mm-hmm.
We surf and you discover that there are people writing in Japanese or in Russian or in Armenian. It can be a discovery. So one of the possible remedies can be this continual contradiction between TV and the internet. For the rest, I am not a prophet.
Right. And unlike the big media, the internet is not top down. It's not. It's bottom up. It can come from everywhere. Giovanni is calling from North Haven, Connecticut. Thank you for calling, Giovanni.
Hi, Jack. How are you today?
Just fine, thank you.
My question is for Umberto Eco. If you see a comparison between Berlusconi's status and hand grip on the Italian medias and European medias, and perhaps George Bush oil lobbying power throughout the American society, which is not media related but financially related to the population, and if he sees a correlation between the two of them, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Essentially, the economic interests of a leadership class of countries. Umberto Eco, your comment?
But it always happened and happens that a political figure is in some way linked to some economical power.
Mm.
It's simply an illusion to think of a leader who is independent of any pressure. So you can speak of the connection of Bush with the petrol people in the Midwest and so on and so forth. The case of Berlusconi is a blatant one because he in himself, a economical protagonist.
Mm-hmm.
It is not a politician who has links.
I see. Yes.
With the economic, he is the economical power. That is the is the peculiar aspects of the. Of the story.
He owned the media
in a way,
empire.
He's more honest. He says, I am making my own interests, okay?
right.
He doesn't lie.
Yeah. Giovanni, thanks for your call. Bill is calling from Concord, Massachusetts. Welcome to the program, Bill.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. My question for Umberto is, and this is something that I struggle with in trying to make sense out of it, is the whole run-up to the war in Iraq. On the one hand, I don't ever recall a war being so worldwidely protested, even before it began.
Mm-hmm.
Millions of people, not hundreds of thousands, millions. It's unprecedented. I think, you have a better grasp of history than I do. I can't think of another war. So on the one hand, it seems to me that's a real positive vote for intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, with all that intelligence out on the street, the incredible power of worldwide, and particularly American stupidity, that even though there were so many people protesting, millions of people protesting, there was no action on the part of the government to stop a war that so clearly was a war of aggression based on out-and-out, bald-faced lies that were immediately available to anyone who took the time to think about it. So my question is, the run-up to the war in Iraq, is that a sign of positive, that things are actually getting better? Or is it a sign of the negative because, in spite of that, it had absolutely no effect on the course of events?
Oh, what a haunting question. Umberto Eco?
Yeah. it's not an easy question because there are two aspects in that question. One, in the first chapter of my book, I just insist on how the notion of war had changed in the last, let's say, 30 years, from the first Gulf War. And a lot of people understood it. And when the Iraq invasion was clearly a return backwards to the old wars instead of a new way to cope with the situation, a lot of people realized it. I mean, people are not stupid, and they reacted. Now, the second half of the question is, it seems that that reaction as an expression of a critical capacity was not influencing the government. Well, other aspects of my book insist on that fact. I remember that when starting the war with Japan, the American government asked the greatest anthropologist of the time, or one of the greatest one, Ruth Benedict, to write a report on the Japanese mentality. That report was a book which became famous, The Chrysanthem and the Sword, and that book was read by generals, by many persons, and helped the United States to be ferociously in war with Japan, but trying to understand the point of view of that civilization. For instance, they decided not to bomb Kyoto because they understood that that could have been such an offense that the hostility would have lasted for centuries and so. So, I mean, now that was an example of how a government can ask culture, science, to make clear what happens.
Right.
Then it happened to me to read the marvelous book of certain Hopkirk on the Great Game, which tells what happened in Afghanistan in the 19th century to the Russian and to the British armies when they tried to invade this territory without knowing the mental, the tribal mentality, the orographic situation, and they were massacred. Now, if that time the administration had read the book of Hopkirk, the military operation would have been different. So there was not respect for what the culture can provide as a knowledge of the world situation.
Yes, yes, and of course the there's an article, I haven't read it partly because it would be too painful, but an article in an American Journal Now that basically says don't blame him, with a portrait of George Bush, and the implication is blame yourself, that this war is something the American public, by at the time it began, 70% believed should be fought. And this in the face of what we've learned about war and what especially you have learned, you Europeans have learned about war, as an institution, it's over, isn't it? I mean, you've learned that, and Europe has passed through that lesson, but we haven't in America, partly because we haven't had your terrible history of it. We still think we can do things through war, accomplish things.
But, you know, I wouldn't like to say that this is only a typical modern or postmodern situation. Took the example of Hitler when he decided to invade Russia, being sure to settle the situation in few months. Hitler hadn't read War and Peace by Tolstoy. Yeah. If he read it, he would have understood why Napoleon couldn't succeed.
Yes.
Because the territory was too big, the winter was approaching. It was enough to read War and Peace to understand that you couldn't invade Russia.
that would have stopped it. And the analogous situation would be just before the invasion of Iraq, George Bush was quoted as saying to somebody, hey, do you know the difference between these Shiites and Sunnis? Let's hear from Ralph calling from Dorchester, Mass. Thank you for calling On Point.
Yeah, Jack, I want to follow up with Professor Echo's talking about literature and war. And in his article about 9/11, he said, why did not Tony Blair tell George Bush about Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson's experience in Afghanistan?
Yeah. And yes, with the My Wonder battle in which Dr. Watson was wounded. And well, even by reading Sherlock Holmes, you could understand how difficult it was to do something in Afghanistan. But probably not even Tony Blair read Conan Doyle.
Yes, the owl of Minerva always takes flight after the events have long since happened. And of course, over here we know that not only were such books not read, that even the studies that the State Department and the Defense Department and others had done on the future of Iraq and what should be done, how we should handle it, all that was just, as we know, thrown away, discarded. Rumsfeld and the other principals didn't even look at it. We're talking this hour with Italian author Umberto Eco. Do you agree that civilization is tumbling backwards? Are you a pessimist of the intellect but an optimist of the will? My guest today is Umberto Eco. He's best known for his novel, The Name of the Rose, and he's just out with a new collection of essays called Turning Back the Clock. Umberto Eco, I just quoted there, or probably misquoted, Gramsci, pessimist of the intellect, optimist
yes,
of the will.
Yes.
Is that do you think that's how we should live in this modern world, or how people do live, that we have to be pessimists of the intellect when we look at things, but on the other hand, we also have to be optimists of the will in order to get through the day?
Ironically, I would say the contrary of Gramsci. I am an optimist of the intellect and the pessimist of the will. I think that's sometimes impossible to do something, and we have to surrender. But in the long run, the earth will survive, the mankind will go on, and so we have to continue.
Bob is calling from Hamilton, Ontario. Hello, Bob.
Oh, hi there, On Pointers. Basically, what I wanted to say was that I'm in agreement with much of what Alberto is saying. However, I do want to quibble with the word backwards. I don't know about civilization going backwards. What's the solution for backwards? To go forwards? I thought we were going forwards. The better word, I think, and I'm indebted to Jane Jacobs for it, is forgetting.
Mm.
And it has a simple solution. Well, let's remember. And she has a number of things that she mentions. And also to another author, Charles Adams, who wrote a tremendous history of taxation, and has many, it has many implications for what we're talking about today in terms of how people are changing to becoming distrusting and dishonest because of high taxation.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so basically, you know, what I see is things that we've forgotten about being unleashed.
Mm.
Where he mentions, Alberto mentions the Crusades and, mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. so on. I see that the European powers back 1,000 years ago had an understanding of what was going on,
right,
and basically bottled up or mm-hmm. or pushed back mm-hmm. Islamic areas into
right.
non-European areas. You know, so that what we've got now is a complete reversal in it by another means.
Right, Bob, we've got it. Let's try Umberto Eco on that. Umberto Eco, memory versus regression. What do you think about that? Memory is an answer to this sense, this backward recurso.
Well, in what I said until now, it was implied that sometime to have an historical memory of what happened before can help to go. All the examples I made were
right.
examples of a lack of historical memory. But this intervention has suggested me a reflection. I wouldn't like to make people think that going backwards is always negative because civilization is always going forwards. Mm. Sometimes we need some steps backwards.
Mm-hmm.
We need some steps backwards in the same sense in which a painter, when painting his canvases, needs sometimes to step backwards to look at a certain distance and to understand what he's doing. For instance, but take ecology.
Mm-hmm.
Ecology is a philosophy of going reasonably backwards.
Mm-hmm.
Huh?
Mm-hmm.
There are too many cars. We should eliminate some cars. Sometimes going forwards means to reasonably go backwards because we have exaggerated with something.
Mm-hmm.
It seems that this reflection has nothing to do with the previous one, but I think that there is a link because even the will of solving situation with war, with an enormous employ of energy, is another way of not understanding that going backwards sometimes can help
yes.
to save the planet.
Yeah. yes. Bob, thank you for your call. Jim is calling from East Hartford, Connecticut. Hello, Jim.
Hi. I'd like to just make one point. In World War II, Italy, Germany, and Japan were defeated, and they have since been the most peaceful countries in their foreign policy, where we won the war, along with the Russians, I guess, and the rest of the Allies, but since then, we've been in constant war and interfering in the affairs of other countries. We have completely lost our humility, and it's as if we're now buying into the idea of we're a super race, just like Hitler sold the Germans. And if a politician talks humility to the American people, he won't be elected.
Although ironically, George Bush in the 2000 campaign criticized the Clinton foreign policy. He said we needed a more humble foreign policy. But your point is well taken. Umberto Eco, the the tutelage of defeat in Europe as against the elixir of victory here in America?
Well, so, somebody told once, by joking, but with the nuance of truth, that it's more convenient to lose wars than to win them. But I want to stress what happens now in Europe. It has been told this, that while 50, 60 years ago and all the centuries before, it was very natural for an Italian to think to a possible war against Austria or mm-hmm. Germany, mm-hmm. to a Frenchman to a possible mm-hmm. war against Germany or Great Britain, to a British possible war against... So it was a normal condition. Since 1945, it is, by now, absolutely impossible for a German to think that one day or another he could be in war with France.
Mm. Inconceivable.
The idea of war has disappeared from the European consciousness, in the same way in which it's impossible today in America for somebody living in Massachusetts to think to a war against North Carolina, South Carolina. Okay, while it happened. Mm-hmm. It happened. So, if it was possible in Europe to reach that situation of the consciousness of the impossibility of the war, just because that continent suffered so much of wars and a horrible massacre there happened, the Holocaust, and so on and so forth, that at a certain point they have decided that war is a taboo. Mm. Like the incest.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
In other countries, evidently, this process is not accomplished. Also, for evident reasons, it is impossible to stay in peace if one is menaced by. I mean, that's why I said it's more convenient to lose wars than to win them.
Right. Right. Although
there should come a moment, even in the rest of the world, by which the idea of two countries fighting one against the other would look paradoxical, comical.
Yes.
Now it's comical to think to a battle between a French and German army. Mm-hmm. It's comic. It's pure. Mm-hmm. It's pure. It's a right. science fiction.
Right. But they're not
Why
laughing.
Not to arrive? Eh?
But they're not laughing in Iraq.
No, right. Enough, obviously, but we should arrive to
yes,
that, to
yes.
That
you know, on the continental United States in World War II. Five people died from direct enemy action. A family in Oregon, a Japanese incendiary device landed near their car. They went to look at it. It blew up, killed all five. Those were the only deaths suffered on the North American continent in World War II.
So the country wasn't accustomed to it.
Yes. Jim, thanks for that excellent call. Kate is calling from Roslindale, Massachusetts. Thank you for calling, Kate.
Hi, Jack. Hi, I'm Virgo. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to make a point about regarding civilization going backwards. I think that there is a real problem now with the proliferation of information and the easy access that we have to so much information and so much media information around us all the time that it results in a kind of static that maybe stalls or goes against deep thought, deep thinking, and maybe personal discovery, you know, inventive thinking. And that's something that I think is, a typically contemporary problem.
That the Internet, which Umberto was looking at in a positive light, it can be a double-edged sword, the sort of information that's available out there.
Yes, so much. I think that there's more of a tendency now to skim the surface of many things.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe not so much to, I don't know, really go deeply. I mean, people do still, but, you know, maybe that's maybe there's kind of a stalling that's happening now.
As we wait for fuller information to arrive. Umberto Eco?
Every problem has always a double face.
Yeah.
Somebody told that even the 40s existed internet, the Holocaust would have not been possible.
Mm.
Because a million of people would have been informed in some way.
Mm-hmm.
And couldn't say, I don't know. So it would have been impossible, at least with the dimensions and with the techniques and with the strategy that took place.
Indeed, yeah.
Information makes a war impossible, because to make a reasonable war, you nation number one should keep secret your movements and your to nation number two.
Mm.
Now everybody knows what happens on the other side.
Right.
So this excess of information makes the old kind of war impossible. That's why I was saying we are going backwards. We are making old wars in the moment in which the triumph of information makes the old wars impossible or lost from the beginning.
Kate, thank you for your call. Sarah is calling from Virginia Beach, Virginia. Hello.
Hi. The question I have is, there was a book written called The Dumbing Down of America, and I wonder if the fact that the average intelligence level of the American public is decreasing, whether that has anything to do with why this war was allowed to happen and has been allowed to go on, and why the American system is not as good as it should be, like the education system isn't as good as it should be. But does the fact that the intelligence level of the country going down, does that have anything to do with this?
Umberto?
Well, I am not an American citizen, so I wouldn't and I couldn't like to make subtle analysis of the present state of American intelligence. You know, there was a book entitled The Decline of Literacy written 20 years ago about that problem. Usually when people speak of a decline of intelligence, they are always a little apocalyptic, because in Europe, we speak continuously of the fact that people do not read any longer enough. Then we see at any step enormous bookstores of several floors full of young people browsing. And so what happens?
Mm-hmm.
Evidently, there is still somebody reading.
Yes.
For the decline of intelligence, there are problems connected to the school organization.
For instance,
I know that in this country there is a problem in high schools, but probably not all of them are equal and are the same. But I know that one of the central problems is the weakness of the high school.
Indeed. Between
the elementary school and the university. University are usually pretty good,
right,
and primary school, but the high school is the moment in which then you read on the newspaper that the boy kills
that's a weakness. Let me just ask you in conclusion, you were 13 and a half in 1945 when Americans, quote, liberated your village in Italy. Can you describe that moment for us?
Oh, yes. Let me make some advertising or publicity, because my last novel, The Mysterious Flame of the Queen Loana, tells the story of the buildings, or the formation of a young man under the fascism at the moment of the arrival of the what I tried to in that story, that was practically biographical, even though it was a novel, and so the character was another, which is not me. But what happened is that we grew up under the fascist education. Okay, we told the myths of the glory of the country, the beauty of death, the inferiority of the other races, and so on and so forth. But on the same time, we were still reading the American comic books and watching the American movies until 42. and maybe a little later. So I learned through Mickey Mouse journalist that there was the freedom of press and so on.
And then it was black soldiers who came to your village. Umberto Eco, we have to go. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Bye-bye.
I'm Jack Beatty, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.